welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. We are Jenny Nordback and Sarah Hawley, and this week we have a slightly different format than usual. I got the chance to sit down with Jennifer Ryan and Laura Lee Gerke during an event at the Huntington Beach Library, but since we were really tight on time, they were much shorter individual episodes than normal, so I've combined them into one episode for your listening pleasure. I wouldn't want to abandon you with a short episode in the middle of your commute or while you're trying to put your laundry away. Jennifer Ryan is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of suspenseful contemporary romances. We chat about her brand new surprise grandbaby, her Wild Rose Ranch series, and why she's drawn to stories with complicated family dynamics. Laura Lee Gerke is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of historical romance. We chat about her latest book, Heiress Gone Wild, and the rest of the books in the Dear Lady True Love series. We also discuss her writing process, her advice for aspiring authors, and why none of us should move to Idaho. With no further ado, here is our interviews, or here are both of our interviews with Jennifer Ryan and Laura Lee Gerke. I am joined today by Jen Ryan, and Jen was just telling me the craziest story, and I was like, can we please tell this while we're recording, because she just became a grandma for the first time.
I did, for the first time.
And it did not look like the normal discovery that you're going to be a grandma.
No, I'm a romance writer, so it was kind of funny that my son actually presented me with a secret baby, which sounds kind of like, you know, he knew and didn't tell me about it, but that's not what happened at all. His girlfriend found out that she was pregnant when she was 8 months pregnant, like 8 months long. And it's like, how can you not know that you're pregnant? That's not a thing.
How does this happen? You always hear this. And I'm like, that's not a thing.
So, I mean, the gist of the story is that, you know, of course, she didn't have regular cycles. So, you know, she didn't know that she was pregnant at first. And then she got really sick one night, had massive chest pains, and her parents took her to the ER because she still lives at home. She's in college. And so they get to the ER and she's like, you know, I have terrible chest pains. I can't breathe and I'm not feeling well. And her father's like, we think she's pregnant and you can't do the x-rays. And they're like, okay, we'll do a blood test on her to be sure before we run the x-rays. And so the nurse comes back and is like, okay, all your blood work came back negative. And let's do the x-rays. So they take the chest x-rays and they say to her, it's, you know, your heart is fine, your chest is clear, you don't have pneumonia, you just have an extreme case of acid reflux because she's five months pregnant.
Oh my God.
Which they told her she
wasn't. Perfect storm.
But then on top of that, she's also extremely lactose intolerant. And so she has a ton of stomach issues all the time. I mean, there's milk and all kinds of products that you buy. And so she's constantly taking the lactate pills and everything. And so she kept not feeling well and not feeling well. And so she'd call the nurse helpline and be like, you know, I'm really not feeling good. I think I need to be seen. You know, and I'm really concerned that, you know, maybe I really, you know, I could be pregnant. Things feel weird and I don't know what's happening. And they would be like, no, 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 you're lactose intolerant. You have acid reflux. You know, of course you have stomach issues. It's fine. And so finally,
when you said the baby was like sideways.
Had a real pregnancy test instead of this fake blood test that they ran. They did say to her, actually, you are pregnant, but we think you're only a couple months along. So, you know, we'll do an ultrasound. So they do the ultrasound, and even the ultrasound tech is like, you don't look 8 months pregnant. And she went, excuse me? And the tech is like, you're like 33 weeks along. Didn't you know? And she's like, well, she didn't know what to say. She was like, no, they kept telling me I wasn't pregnant. You're saying I'm 8 months pregnant? They were like, yeah. And they're like, it's funny because you don't really look pregnant because the baby is actually sideways instead of like, you know, butt out, big belly out. It was sideways. So she looked like she had gotten a little wider, but not rounder.
So like any one of these things kind of
any
like, and it would have been
things.
Obvious, but oh my, perfect
swarm. I mean, even when I saw her, when she would come to visit my son and, or they'd, you know, be at the house and stuff like that, I was like, oh, well, maybe Maddie's put on a little, you know, college 15 or so, you know, college 10, college 15, you know, it happens. Okay. She's a young woman. She'll, you know, she'll work it off, you know, kind of.
Or she won't, and that's fine.
Or in 5 weeks, she'll hand me a grandson.
5 weeks to process that you're going to be a grandma.
Yeah. So we actually moved my middle son off to college. We moved her into the house, and 5 weeks later, we had a little boy. His name is Hunter. Oh. And so he's been with us now for a month, and he's just adorable, and we're so in love with him, but I keep calling him the secret baby.
Yeah. That's going in a book.
I know. I was just like, so it actually does. I've always
And when
said
readers
that too.
Are like, that's not believable. That's you can be like, believable. Let me tell you.
This is actually what happened. Yeah. And I've always been like that. I'm like, I even said to her, how did you not know? She's like, well, there were things that I thought were like weird, but her health issues just were like, could explain away a lot of the stuff. And so we felt really bad for her. Cause like you said, that was a huge, like,
at 20, trying to process, you have 5 weeks to process that you're going to be a mom.
Well, the baby was due. He came 12 days early too. So she, I mean, she.
No. She thought she had longer to figure it out.
She thought she had longer. And then she's, you know, young and doing well and healthy. And they told her the baby was perfectly healthy and everything. And then she literally had a 2.5 hour labor. That baby came and we almost had the baby in the car because we just was like, so I dropped her at the ER with my son and they went up. I parked the car and ran up and she had already had the baby. Two pushes. The girl is amazing.
This is not a thing. She's a unicorn.
She's a unicorn.
I had that with my second baby where like I waited too long and had no idea that I almost had the baby in the car and just like barely made it in. And they were like, baby's coming now. Like
she
right
literally
this
started labor at 9:30 and had the baby at 12:21. I mean, her first contraction was at 9:30 at like, after about an hour and 20 minutes or so, I was like, I think maybe we need to like call the hospital and tell them like she's really in labor. And then all of a sudden it went to like back-to-back contractions and then her water broke. And I was like, we are out of here. We need to go now.
Oh man. Yeah. I'm ready for a lot of things, but delivering this baby myself is not one of them.
No, not going to happen. I'm like, I'm not writing that story.
That is wild.
Wild. So yeah, so that's been my last 2 months.
Yeah, I could imagine that would be all consuming.
Crazy.
Yeah. But congratulations.
Thank you.
My parents have said just how wild it is to be a grandparent that like, I guess it's a little different for you because you are living with the baby, but.
Yes, he lives in our house. They're both still in college and both working. And so I do, since I'm a writer and I can work from home, I'm just like, I'm the perfect person to be with baby all the time.
Yeah.
So you guys can finish your education and do what you need to do.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And everything. And so, yeah, so he's home with us and he's got, you know, my daughter is there as well. She loves being an aunt. So she's always threatening to steal the baby, which she does often.
Yeah.
We're like, where did he go?
Baby napper. My mom was accused of that when mine were little. It was like, stop stealing the baby. You have to let someone else hold them.
I know. You just can't help it. He's so darn cute.
No. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad it has an HEA.
Like, it does. A very happy HEA. She's very happy living with us and they're together as a little family. It's really sweet to watch them together, especially to see my son in such a, you know, step up and be the dad and, you know, take on that role and taking care of his little family now. And so it's like, it's really sweet to watch.
But they have the safety net where they can still finish school and, you know.
Definitely. I mean, we wanted
so
to make sure that they made that a priority. I mean, if they're going to have this life together and provide a good life for their son, then it was like, you guys need to finish your educations. And they were both, you know, working so hard at it. And then to have this kind of, you know, come upon them suddenly.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't have 9 months to prepare. So like, she's like in the middle of her semester. So she took 2 weeks off of school and that was it. And she was back in class.
Wow.
I was just like.
And telling your professors that, like you couldn't have given us a heads up.
But, I know.
Yeah.
But her professors were really great. And even my son had to miss a test. And he's like, I'm sorry, but my girlfriend just delivered our baby. And so the teacher was like, okay, you get a pass.
That's an
on
excuse.
This one.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
I'll give you that.
So you have many books.
Many books.
You are, could we use prolific at this point? Like a
definitely
prolific author.
Prolific. Yeah.
I've actually
turned in the next 4 books that are going
to
be published.
No way. Well, that's good if you're writing process is a little interrupted right now.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have like built-in time.
So will it work that way with the schedule that you can kind of take some time right now and just focus on baby?
Yes. Or? So right now I'm doing edits for a book that comes out in June. I just worked out that I had written all the romance books. This is a women's fiction book that I wrote that I actually kind of threw into the schedule in between all the romances. So I'm just working on the edits for that right now. So that's, you know, pretty easy rather than having to like write a book and be creative with like, you know, a baby crying every 3 hours saying, feed me.
Yeah. Yeah, they do that. That is a thing.
Yeah. So that book is The Silva Sisters Secrets, which I just finished. And it's a women's fiction. So it's about three sisters and it's set in Carmel and it's like a big family saga and big drama going on and revealing all of the secrets that the sisters have either kept from each other or that they're holding on to themselves that they don't want anybody to know about. So that was a really fun book to write. That was a little bit different than writing the series that I write in romance.
Yeah. And in romance, yours that I've read are cowboy. Is that's your signature?
I write Western romances and all of them have a thread of suspense in them usually of some sort, whether that's, you know, will they or won't they get together and like maybe something's keeping them apart or if there is like a big suspense plot like a murder or I wrote a whole series called Montana Heat where they were all DEA agents. So they all had DEA cases going on in the books. And so I like to throw in suspense in there too just to like make things fun and
keep it a little chaotic.
Yeah.
So the current series is the Wild Rose Ranch.
That's
Am I getting that right?
Yes.
Oh, I never get the series title right. I'm not going to get the book titles though. They all blend together after
a while.
That's
okay. Yeah. So the Wild Rose Ranch series is something a little bit different. And I had never seen anything like it. And I got the idea from watching an HBO documentary called Cat House, which is about legal brothels in Nevada.
Yep.
And so I was flipping through the channels and I came across this and was like, oh, well, that's kind of interesting. And they were interviewing this woman who worked there. And she was talking about how she was a single mother. She lived in the Midwest and she would fly into the Bunny Ranch once a month for a week. And she would work for that week and she would make more money there in that week than she would have working a whole year at like, you know, a fast food restaurant. And that she would then fly home to her mother would watch the two children while she was at work. And when she flew home, she was a stay-at-home mom. And that's what she did there. And nobody knew what she did outside of that. And that was her life. And so my thought was, you know, what if you were the children of this woman who's doing a job that's legal, but maybe not morally acceptable to a lot of people? And what if you were that child and you actually grew up in that life? And so the Wild Rose Ranch series is four sisters, a set of twins, and then two other sisters. They're not actually sisters, but they grew up together at the ranch, living in a separate property across from the legal brothel, the Wild Rose Ranch, where their mothers work. And so they've always known what their mothers do and who their mothers are and grew up there. And at the point we meet them in the books, it's the point where they're ready to start their own lives and like separate themselves from this life and the stigma of what they've grown up with in this small town. Because I guess most people may not know that in Nevada, brothels are not legal in Las Vegas. They're in these small little towns that there's not that many people. Everybody knows everybody.
Business. Small
and
towns.
It's a small town. And so these girls have grown up going to school with the same kids who all know what their mothers did, who all treated them like, oh, that's what you're going to be when you grow up and stuff. And so they're at the point in their lives where they've educated themselves. They've gone to college. They've kind of taken the Wild Rose Ranch name. They became rodeo stars in their own right. They all ride horses. And so they've kind of, you know, tried to make the name their own in their own way, but now they really want to make a life that's their own. And so Roxy inherits her. She's the only one who knows who her father is. The other girls don't know who their fathers are. So in book one, Dirty Little Secrets, she inherits a ranch. And she goes there and she finds out that she's always known that she had a stepbrother and a stepsister who were not blood relation to her father, but he raised them as their own. And so he gave away the daughter he biologically is connected to and raised two other children. So there's a lot going on in the dynamics there of like family and, you know, love and respect and, you know, who your parents are and whether you can look up to them or not, and have they done well by you or not, or have you had to do for yourself your whole life? And that's kind of Roxy's story. She's always had to stand on her own. And then book two is coming out next week on the 12th. It's Restless Rancher. So in Dirty Little Secrets You Meet, Noah is on the ranch, and Noah's best friend is Austin, and he's this guy who's just completely down on his luck. And his father has basically stripped him of his wealth, his land, everything. And the only thing he has left is a piece of land that his grandfather left to him. And it's this just worn down, dilapidated ranch that he can't do anything with. And he's pretty much become a drunk and a lost cause. And Roxy decides that, you know, she's up for a good lost cause. She thinks that people can be redeemed. And people, you know, when family has torn you down, maybe all you need is a hand up. And so she's that hand up to Austin. But she brings her sister Sonia in to keep him on track. Her sister's an accountant. And numbers are her game. And she's like going to keep him on task. And she's going to make sure that they rebuild this ranch and it's prosperous. And her sister's making money. But then she meets Austin. And, you know, the two of them start seeing each other in a whole new light for each other, too.
Yeah, yeah. I think... So one of the things, I haven't read that one yet. It just arrived at my house and it's got a hot cowboy in like dark colors on the cover.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, yeah. One of the things that I was curious about is that when you explained the idea for the series and where it came to you as like this mom who's kind of like, I'm a single mom. This is the cards I've been dealt. I'm going to go do what I need to do and I'm going to come back to my kids. I think I sort of admire that story. But at least in Roxy's book, her mom is not a character that you would admire. She is more of the like stereotypical sex worker who's like, I don't remember if she does drugs, but I think she does drugs.
She was, yeah. So when Roxy grew up as a young girl, her mom was kind of working the streets. She was into drugs. She prostituted in order to buy more drugs. And that was the life Roxy kind of was brought up in. And then her mother is taken to the Wild Rose Ranch and given this opportunity. Like, here is a place that you can live and work and be safe, and Roxy can live in this separate place and be safe. And so her mother goes there, but her mother likes who she is. She likes the life she leads, and she doesn't care who knows it. And so Roxy kind of has a hard time, you know, dealing with that, that her mother just is who she is, and she cannot change her mother. Her mother loves this life and thinks that, you know, it's glamorous and, you know, she falls in love every night, basically, and that's just her world. And, you know, men adore her, you know, for a little while, and that's enough for her. And that's all she really wants, where Roxy really wants... Roxy has always longed for a home and a real family and people she could count on, because she's never had that. And that's what she's looking for when she meets Noah at the ranch and meets her little sister and finds kind of like, you know, well, you guys, we're not, just like her and her sisters are, we're not all blood, but we are family in a way.
It's that like chosen family.
Exactly, yeah. So in book two, you meet Sonia's mother, and Sonia's mother, has a completely different story. She was, you know, abused as a child and, you know, comes to the Wild Rose Ranch, kind of this broken person who thinks that that's all she's good for because that's all she's ever been used for. And so she's her mental capacity has kind of been stunted as a child. And so she's kind of quiet and just, you know, reserved and that, just accepting that this is the life, this is the only life I will ever have, and has just accepted it. But she looks at the Wild Rose Ranch as a safe place. Nobody will harm her there. She'll do her job. She will get paid. She will be able to support her daughter. Her daughter lives in a beautiful house. They come from this rural place in Kentucky where they had absolutely nothing growing up, dirt poor. And so to her, living in a mansion, even if it's a brothel, is, you know, like a princess story castle, right? For her, in her mind. And for Sonia, she just wants so much better for her mother. She doesn't want her mother to live this life thinking that that's all she's worth. And in the story, you'll see how not only does Roxy find a happy ever after, but her mother finds a way to find a new path and a new life as well. So I like to show the moms, because I think, you know, you'd be surprised how many different ways. I mean, people don't grow up and be like, I think I'll be a prostitute, you know, for a living. There are reasons women, like, you know, end up in those places and why they're there and why they find that life to be, you know, a life that they can relate to and work in and be in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was sort of my curiosity, was like, how were you going to set up the different mothers and would we see some of the different approaches to that, like why you end up there? And the bomb I'm about to drop is that I'm a former sex worker.
Okay.
And so like, I'm very much reading it from that perspective and looking at the moms and looking at my kids and going, but it's very different from the story that you've set up. Like,
and it is, I think every person's situation is different of how they ended up there and how they come into that work and what they think about it. And like Candy, you know, she has no problem with who she is. She right. enjoys her job, and I present her as that's, and for her, that's her life, and she's happy.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. And then
that she's kind of a terrible mother.
She's a horrible yeah. mother, but as far as like her job and what she does, that's the thing Roxy struggles with, and I hope I've put in the book that you have to separate yourself from the fact that she's a horrible mother
right.
to the fact that, you know, she lives her life the way she wants to live her life.
Right.
Yes, it's awful for Roxy, but you know,
she is who she is.
She is who she yeah. is. And I think that a lot of times in real life, we have a hard time accepting that people are who they are and they do the things they want to do because that's what they want and they don't care what you think.
Well, and the parents don't magically become better people because they have kids. And
exactly.
like, not everyone is necessarily designed to be a parent. And yeah.
Yeah. And in Sonia's case, her mother is good to her. But yet her mother has left her alone, thinking that you are better off living with Roxy and your sisters and being, a group yourselves, a family yourselves. You're better there than you are with me. But yet her mother is in her life all the time. Her mother would see her, you know, visit her, and they had a good relationship otherwise. But her mother just felt like, you know, I think this is the best scenario I can give to you is, you know, is this other life with your sisters where you can go to school and have a normal life. To her, that was like, that's not what she had. She didn't get to go to school. She lived in, you know, squalor. Her uncles abused her. Her uncles, you know, prostituted her out when she was a young girl. And at 14, she ends up pregnant and doesn't know what to do with this baby. So it was a very difficult life for her. And Sonia knows she's doing the best she can.
Yeah.
Right? You know?
And I think all of these are legitimate ways that women come to sex work. Like, these are true stories that, like, happen for a lot of women. I would love to see one of the moms not be a terrible mother who's been, like, abused and maybe, like, subverts those sex worker expectations, because I don't, like, I was exactly what you said, where it was, like, I wasn't abused. I came from not like a wealthy background, but like privileged in the sense that, like, you know, I'm a white middle-class American and was in university and was just like, how am I going to pay my student loans? I could go do this and make not very much money, or I could do this, which I'm totally comfortable with, and make significantly more money and like learn some really interesting stuff about people. And I chose the crazy path, and like, it was fine. I didn't start doing drugs. I like had a great experience, learned a lot, stepped away from it when I was ready. And like, now I'm happily married and have kids. And I think that is more common than people realize. Like, I think we hear a lot of the sort of horror stories, but it is interesting to look at the other side of sex work sometimes. So it sounds like the next four books are already written. So my request is possibly irrelevant, but I think
the last book is actually the twins' book, and their mother is a little bit different in that, you know, she was just like, you know, homeless and was about to lose the girls and things were not going right. She was kind of into drugs too. And the madam of the Wild Rose Ranch actually, it comes in to save the girls more than she is to save the mother. Because she sees the twins and that they need some place to be. And so she kind of comes in that way. And the twins' story, they're together in the last book, which is called Tough Talking Cowboy. And fans of my series, if you read His Cowboy Heart, At the end of the book, you meet Drake McGrath, who is ex-military and has PTSD, and he meets Jamie, who's the heroine of that book. And so he is the hero in the last Wild Rose Ranch book.
Not for both twins?
No.
Okay.
Just for one of the twins.
I was like, whoa. I thought you had said they were together, like they just have one book for both of them.
Okay. The two twins have one book, story together, all together. So, and I really love the book because he's suffering from PTSD and Adria, who will be his love interest, is one of the twins. She's kind of overcome an episodes of PTSD in her life. And so her perspective on his life kind of shakes him out of his, you know, out of his, I don't know, kind of wallowing in this self-pity and this dark pit that he's in a very dark place when she meets him. And she's just like, hey, you know, here's what you need to do. And he kind of needs this wake-up call. And he hasn't been able to hear it from his family or anybody around him. But when it comes from her, all of a sudden he's just like, he hears about what her life was like and how she grew up and everything. And he's like, well, if she can like come out of this, then I can come out of this, kind of a thing. So their combined strength helps them both kind of rise above.
Why Western romance? Like what?
This is fun. I actually live in California and I live in the Bay Area and we go to the Central Valley all the time. And when I was a young girl, I had a friend who had a ranch and I lived kind of in a very suburban area. And we went to school together. But on the weekends, when I wanted to go see her, I would drive out to her ranch. And that was not that far away, maybe 15 miles. That's how close, like, you know, the rural area was back in the day. but I would go to her ranch and her, she had horses and her uncle would put us up on the horses. And, you know, we were like 9, 10 years old. And he would be like, see those cows way out there? Go get them. And bring them back. And we were like, okay, that sounds like fun. And so we would go out and do that. And we would just ride in the fields and stuff. And I just thought, this is like the perfect life. Like, I love it here. It's like wide open spaces. We get to ride the horses all day and just, you know, hang out in the outside. And I grew up in a house with an alcoholic. And so this was just like an escape for me. It was just like, I just loved being on a horse. I loved flying across the field and making it go as fast as I could and, you know, scaring the pants off myself. And like, you know, I just felt free out there. And it was like, I just always was like, this is like the greatest place ever. And I just loved going to visit her all the time. And so when I started writing, the first series I ever wrote was called The Hunted Series. And it was all set in like San Francisco and the FBI guys and stuff like that. And in one of the books, the guy has a brother, and I was just like, you know, they were having the wedding, and I was like, his three brothers arrive, and I said to my editor, I was like, you know, I'm just going to call them the Montana men for right now, because they live in Montana on these ranches, and they're going to fly in for the wedding, and I'm just calling them Montana men. And my agent called me like 2 days later, and he's like, your editor wants to buy some series called the Montana men?
Oh.
And I was like, he's like, what is that? And I was like, nothing. It's just three brothers and a name that I gave them. And he's like, well, she wants to buy three books of the Montana Men. So, like,
so
we're putting this deal together.
So you stumbled into cowboy romance.
So it was like, okay. But I was like a huge Linda Lale Miller fan. And I loved Western romance. Diana Palmer. I read and devoured all of those books because of my love of the ranch from my childhood. Like, I loved reading Western romances. So it wasn't far of a stretch for me to be like, okay, I could write like a Montana Men book. Okay,
yeah. They're set there. I mean, the Montana Men, that just sounds...
And all of the books are still kind of suspense-y. There's not a whole lot of ranching going on in the books. It just happens to be where these guys are from. And I mean, when you think of like, you know, ranching and that life and the men who do that, the strength that they have, the integrity that they have, a handshake is, you know, everything. I just love that kind of, you know, personality to write of like these guys who are really, really tough, but maybe something's happening in their lives, or maybe, you know, a woman comes into their lives and really shakes it up. You know, it's not all about ranching anymore. It's about something more than that.
Yeah. And capable, so, like guys who can do things.
Guys who can do things. Like, can you fix this? You know?
I find it interesting, and this might cross a line into too personal for you, so we can back right out of it if you want to. But It's that thing where like you never know what other people have gone through. So, you know, we sit down together and you have no idea as we're talking about the conversation that I'm a former sex worker. And that's what I'm bringing to the table as I'm looking at your books.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting that you commented that you grew up with an alcoholic and like that's your perspective and that I'm probably reading into this, but maybe that's why you're interpreting the parents in those romances that way, where it's like these characters are having to overcome their parents. And it's less about like them specifically being a sex worker or like the sex worker representation that's in that book. And it's more just like, that's the story that you know how to tell because it's coming from an authentic place for you.
I definitely think that's true because, you know, my life was very tumultuous growing up. There's a couple books that I've written where, you know, the girl has like an alcoholic father or something like that. And that kind of plays out as far as like, you know, my mentality and what it's like to live with somebody like that. But I definitely think when you talk about like, you know, the Wild Rose Ranch women, that for the girls, it's about overcoming like what their parents put on them, because that's how I feel. I feel like my father put on to me, changed me. He changed who I could have been because of the way I was treated, right?
Yeah.
I mean, every time you're like verbally abused or somebody tells you you're worthless or they don't want you or you just feel unloved, I think that changes you. It alters you. It alters the way you think, the way you look at other people. It alters the way you deal with men in your life as well.
Yeah.
If it's like your father, maybe if it's your mother, the way you deal with women is different, or you see a mom doing something to a child and that affects you in a certain way. It's like visceral. For me, it's like that too. And so when I write my books and I give people their backstories, I really think about like, what happened to them? How would that make them feel? Because I think I'm pretty good about analyzing myself of like, this is what happened and this is how it made me feel. And have I gotten past it or have I not gotten past it? Sometimes I think I have, but then something will trigger me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, maybe I'm not really past that kind of a thing. And I like to do that in the books because I think everybody can understand somebody has hurt you. And then you have to deal with the aftermath of that. And I think everybody has been hurt in some way, shape, or form in their life. But I think it's especially impactful when it's a family member. I wrote a women's fiction book called The Me I Used to Be. And the premise of the book is basically an event can happen in a family to one person, but every person in that family experiences it differently. And I wrote the book from all of their perspectives so that you could see how differently they all do perceive the event. And that's how I've seen my family. What happened to me and my experience of my father is not the same as what my brothers experienced from him or what my mother experienced from him. And how we all dealt with it was very, very different. And I find it fascinating to like talk to my brothers and I'm just like, you don't remember it that way.
Oh,
you don't,
you
don't remember him doing this or you don't remember how he said this to you or how that made you feel.
Well, that's another layer of it because then you're probably second guessing yourself and like.
You do. And then you also think that they don't empathize with you either because they're like, well, that wasn't my experience. And they're right. It wasn't their experience.
Right.
It was my experience, but they saw it and the way they perceived it and then how they, you know, express it to me, whether it was important to them or not, you know, affects you as well. Like, well, don't they even care?
you know?
Or maybe they thought it was really awful and they try to empathize with you and then you have some camaraderie built there, right? And some empathy built there between you and that can bring your relationship closer, especially when, in my case, my father made sure that all of us were pitted against each other. And so it's very hard to connect with them. And so I try to explore those things in books of like, what brings people together? What disconnects them? You know, do people, I think that's the premise of a romance, right? The two main characters see in each other who they really are at the heart of who they are, not just what they put out to the world. And I think in families, people don't do that enough.
Yeah.
You know, they lose that connection and that's how families fracture is you don't see who that person, they're not looking at who that person really is. You know, their sister, their brother, their mother, you know, they kind of
just are looking at what they're putting out there.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to deal with hard things like that.
Yeah.
So.
Do we know in the Me I Used To Be what the event is, or is that like part of the mystery of the book?
It's a little bit of a part of the mystery of the book. So the event that happens is the book opens with the main character, Evangeline. She's sitting in the parole board room trying to get her parole for a crime that she didn't actually commit, but she took the blame for. And she has to, when if they let her out on parole, because she'll be on parole, she needs a place to live, which means she has to go back to her family home. And so her family all think they know what happened, and they all have their own feelings about what happened, but none of them really know what the truth is, and she's hiding that truth from them. And so when the truth is revealed, then they all have to rethink what happened to her, why she did what she did, how it affected them, what she did for them, and how they now move past it and make amends to each other, kind of a thing. So it's like a really kind of, I don't know, dense, like intense family story about, you know, how something can happen and tear a family apart or put them back together, depending on how you handle it and how you look at it.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about writers having those sort of core stories, and it sounds like there's something in there that's part of yours that, like, the two women's fiction books that you've talked about seem to center on that. And like,
I love a good family saga and a big family drama. I mean, my whole family, I mean, extended family and everything. And my husband comes from a very, you know, kind of tumultuous family life as well. And so I just find family fascinating. And when I was young, we would have, you know, we would have what we called potluck. Once a month, a family member would hold it and the whole entire family would get together. And so I would like kind of sit back and watch this play out with everybody and just find it fascinating the way people treated each other and like, what the backstories were and what nobody knew in the room, right? And in my case, it was nobody in this room knows what my dad is really like when he's at home. You know, this is all just a facade. Yeah. And it was crazy to me. I thought, this is nuts.
Yeah.
Like, you people don't know who he is.
Yeah.
It was like, so I just always found that fascinating. And I think just the way my mind works, I'm always kind of analyzing things myself or events or things that are going on. I'm always people watching and like being like, what's going on over there?
Yeah. You know?
What are those two doing over there? Like body language. I find all of that kind of fascinating to just like watch and pay attention to the nuances of things, not just what's like what you think you see.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And yeah, there's so many layers to it. There's like what they want you to see and what you're seeing that may be a, like these hints of what's really under there. And then there's like the deep down in there that like they're probably lying to themselves about.
Yeah. And in my writing, I try to do that. I try to take the reader deeper into whoever the character is. And it's like, this is what, you know, maybe you see their interaction, you know, in something innocuous in the book, but then when they're alone and you get their introspection and stuff, you really get to see, oh, well, deep down, this is what's really going on with her. And that's why I choose characters. I've done a couple, my husband's ex-military, so I've done several military characters. The DEA guys are fascinating, you know, to try and do that kind of work and be in that kind of life and, you know, life and death situations and stuff. I think that changes you as a person. And what kind of mentality do you, I always think, what kind of mentality do you have to do something like that?
Yeah. So I know from Laura Lee Gerke's reference that you are also a pantser.
I am a pantser.
Which, now that I know that you're doing these sort of multi-layered family sagas, that's, and we've only got a couple minutes, so we're going to have to do like a follow-up because we're just scratching the surface here. But how is that, like when all of the pieces impact each other, how the hell are you pantsing that?
So for me, every single book always starts with the first chapter, and it's usually, I usually start the first chapter where you are in either the hero or the heroines, most of the time the heroines, like a dark moment, their darkest moment, something terrible has just happened, and I put you right in that moment. What is the point in their life where something awful happens and everything changes from that point on? So that's kind of, I like to like really draw the reader in, like, here we go.
No, I'm sitting here like, that's a great approach. Like, for writers listening, like, that's such a good way to, because you're, it's like, you're engaged, it's a moment of tension, there's change happening,
exactly.
Their life can't continue on the path that it's on.
You might find the heroine or the hero at their darkest moment at that point. And, you know, people always say, oh, well, you know, in romance, there are weak, you know, heroines are weak or whatever. I don't think that's true. I think you can find somebody who's in their darkest, deepest moment or a weak moment. That doesn't mean they're a weak person. No. They just need time to process and then overcome, to find that inner strength. And it's the process of them overcoming and finding that inner strength that I think is what people latch onto, because in real life, that's what we're all looking for, right? When something happens, we want to, you know, yes, maybe you need to take a moment to like let it sit and let it process. And maybe, you know, you're in a deep depression or whatever it is you're dealing with. But there is a way to find that inner strength, and you just have to dig deep. And that's what that's what I like to show in the books is, you know, that there is this moment where you can find that kind of and pull yourself out of it and know it's not easy, but if you keep working at it, you can get there. And so that's how most of my books start out, is like there's something bad is happening in the beginning, and everything changes from that point on. And so then I move the book forward. And for me, I don't know, that's just where you start. I think if you start in that point, it's like, well, how do I get from that point to happy ever after? And what's going to happen in between? And in a romance, there's certain things that have to happen. You know, she's going to meet the guy or he's going to meet the girl. They're going to, like, you know, get together. Something's going to, you know, try to tear them apart. They'll kiss. They'll have sex. You know, all those things will happen. But also, they have to, like, you know, find that strength to overcome and find the life that they really want to have or whatever it is they're searching for in the book.
Easy peasy.
Oh, sure, easy.
Yeah. When you say it like that, it's like, oh, yeah, you just put these pieces in and it will magically be a book.
Yeah, I don't always know how the end is going to be for the most part. Like I said, I always know the beginning and then I just move them forward from there. One of my best writing tips for people is when I get stuck, I rely on dialogue. What's he going to say? How's she going to respond? Like, that's how I keep moving the forward story. When I'm not quite sure what's happening, it's like, okay, what is he going to say to this situation? How does he feel? Like, you know, and what does she say? And how does she feel in this moment? And that usually keeps me moving the book forward and you know, developing them and getting them to the next part. So there was only one book that I ever wrote where I actually wrote like 3/4 of the book and got to the part where I had to write the end. And I was like, I have no idea how this book ends.
Oh no, that's terrifying.
And I was terrified to call my editor. And for 3 weeks, I didn't write a word, which is unheard of for me. I write almost every single day. And for 3 weeks, I was like, I don't know how this book ends. I think I'm going to have to call her and tell her that I have to scrap the whole book and start over. And I was like, I don't know what to do. And I was like, it's one of those things for me. I always tell people, you know, if you can't get an idea, like do something innocuous. I like to garden, you know, washing the dishes, you let your mind wander. For me, it's always the shower too. Like I'll be in the shower and I'll be like, oh, I have to write this, you know, book, or I need to put this in. And I was in the shower and I was like, oh, like they're not good people. They're bad people. Oh. And then I was like, okay, now I know what's going to happen. And so it was like, it finally came to me. I don't want to give it all away, but it was her Renegade Rancher book. And it has a great ending at the end because it's kind of unexpected. And, but I just like at the
so
end of the
in
book,
the end, it was better than it maybe would have been if it
well,
just come to
all
you.
Well, because all I really had was, you know, an ending that was predictable. And I was like, I can't do that. You know, it just cannot be that simple. And then it's like, oh, and that's what happened. You knew that was what's going to happen and it's over. I was like, it can't be that way. So it just took me, 3 weeks to figure out what I really needed to do.
But it worked.
But
it's fine. So you have to run to an event. There is an audience waiting for you. But if people want to follow you online to learn more about your books, where can they do that?
And they can follow me on Twitter at JenRyan_author. And they can find me on Facebook on Jennifer Ryan. And then they also can find me on my website, jenniferryan.com.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I am joined today by Laura Lee Gerke. Thanks for making the time. We are at the Huntington Beach Library.
Thanks for having me.
You've got an event tonight. And yeah. You're not in a sort of SoCal local, are you?
No, I live in Idaho.
Oh.
They flew me in.
Have you been out here before?
I used to live here.
Okay.
I lived here at one point, yeah.
Okay. Here being like actual
LA.
Huntington? Okay.
Yeah, no, I made the commute from Sherman Oaks to Venice every day for 3 years.
Oh.
On the 405
That's
every day.
Brutal.
Yeah. Brutal.
Man.
Wouldn't have it back.
Yeah.
My commute now is a staircase. It's awesome.
Yeah, you don't realize when you're in the thick of commutes like that, like how much of your day it's eating up.
And no, you just don't. How you much get used to it.
That important you do it. Part of your life that you're spending driving.
And then you're out of it and you're like, how did I ever do that for so long?
Yeah. I used to do Hermosa Beach to Orange.
Yeah.
And it was the same, just absolutely insane. I was spending like 2 hours each way driving. And those are important hours, like before and after work. So.
Yeah.
My husband loves it though. We moved closer to his work recently. He was driving for about an hour each way and he was listening to podcasts. That was like his decompression time.
Yeah, or audiobooks people do. Yeah.
Exactly. So his commute's only like 15 minutes now and he hates it. He's like not ready to be
that's
home
his chilling
by the time,
time
he gets home.
Yeah. Now he doesn't have it. Yeah.
He hasn't like switched off from work yet. So I found that really interesting. But oh, and I think part of it, he's like LA born and raised. So I think if you grew up with the traffic, it maybe doesn't bother you as much.
I grew up with the traffic. I was born here. I was born in North Hollywood and I lived in Agoura as a kid.
And it doesn't apply for you?
My family moved to Idaho when I was like 12. And then I moved back for a job and I wasn't used to it. And I got used to it because you do what you have to do. But when I left it again, I don't ever want to have to drive in that traffic again. It's nerve-wracking.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like tense the whole time.
Yeah.
So he must have some kind of skill for tuning it out. I don't know. But I've heard really good things about Idaho, though. I have not been there, but I think it's kind of a secret, awesome place.
Shh.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
It's going to be the next like Pacific Northwest or Austin where like people are going to start hearing about it.
Yeah, no, it's a horrible place, really. You trust me on this, you don't want to move there. We had a newscaster on our local, one of our local channels who said, I'm not sure if he did the weather or the news, I can't remember, but he said something about how many people have been moving to Boise, which is where I live. And he was saying, you know, we really appreciate all you people coming here and all that. And you can just tell all your friends and relatives in California, we're full.
Yeah, it's the next Boulder. Like I remember when I was living in Boulder, it was like everyone was migrating from California.
Yeah, Boise's like a mini Fort Collins if you've ever lived. I mean, Fort Collins reminds me a lot of Boise. It's kind of a similar vibe and the climate is very similar. Lots of outdoor stuff, lots of great skiing and that kind of thing. So if you're into the outdoors,
but it's horrible and no one should.
Yeah, no one should ever go there.
Like spend their tourist dollars, but then they can leave.
Oh,
again.
As tourists, yeah, come. But that's all I'll say.
And okay, so the fourth book in your series just came out.
Yes,
and I think you just said it's Eris Gone Wild.
Yes, that's the fourth book.
I haven't read it, which is always fun because you can give it to us the way listeners want to hear it. When I've read it, I always jump in with like the details and people are like, but what's the book about again? So give us the premise of the series and then kind of the overall of each book.
The premise of the series is a late Victorian advice column and surrounding a newspaper. And the first book, The Truth About Love and Dukes, is the heroine of that book is the one who started the column and it made her family newspaper a raging success. And then her sister in the second book, Trouble with True Love, has to take it over when she marries, you know, her Duke and goes off to have her honeymoon and live happily ever after. And her sister gets stuck running the paper, which she doesn't want to do, and has to write advice for the lovelorn. And she's very shy and she doesn't want to do it. And ends up hiring the hero to write the advice column. So the hero of book two, Trouble with True Love, becomes the Lady True Love advice columnist. And then the third book sort of takes a turn. And it sort of goes on a feminist bent. The heroine of that book is a governess who got fired and was sexually harassed at her job, basically. And that book's called Governess Gone Rogue. And she gets fired and decides that she's really wants she overhears a conversation between two men about how a woman can't educate, you know, my sons and send them to university. And she has a university education, which for a woman in those days was very rare. And she overhears them talking about it. And she's like, oh, I could do that job. I could totally do that job, but I can't because it's a male tutor job. And she's a governess. She's a woman. She can't do it. So she ends up cutting off her hair and disguising herself and becoming tutor to these two boys. And they're related to the previous two books. They're connected. But that's called Governess Gone Rogue. And then the fourth book, Eris Gone Wild, is also related. The this book is the hero of the first two heroines. So he's the brother of the woman who ran the newspaper. And he's stuck with a ward. And he tries to dump her off on his sisters. And they're not having it. And he's like, crap. Because he wants to go off to Africa and have fun, right? And he's stuck with this very troublesome young woman who is determined to, you know, have fun and cause trouble. And he's like, he can't dump her off on his sisters like he was hoping. And so he has to actually be a guardian to her and make sure she gets a proper husband, which of course ends up to be him in the end.
Of course.
But nobody sees that coming except the reader. Because in romance, some things are just a given, you know.
We don't mind. In fact, I think we would probably be confused and frustrated if we couldn't figure it out immediately.
But it all sort of centers around the advice column and the persona of Dear Lady True Love. And the advice columnist, you know, changes from book to book because the job keeps getting handed off. So it's not like the same character in all the books as Lady True Love. It's sort of a job that's handed off from person to person, but it all centers around that.
And where did the idea for that come from?
Actually, it's kind of funny where that came from because many years ago there was a song, who wrote it originally? It's an old blues song called Wanted Blues. And if anyone knows and loves the blues, I do personally, I love blues music. But it, I wish I could remember who wrote it. I'll think of it probably in the middle of the night. But it's called Wanted Blues. And the one line in it goes, I read your ad, Miss Lonely. I heard you want a real good man. Well, I was thinking, wow, that would make a great book idea. But then it sort of morphed when I actually sat down to write it. It sort of morphed into this advice column. But that was the original nugget of inspiration for it, was that song. So it's really weird how ideas come to you. As an author, you don't know. You're a sponge. You just soak everything up.
Yeah.
And then it comes out in ways that are really unexpected. I wrote a book, it's been quite a while ago now, called Is Every Kiss. And the hero is a composer and who gets tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ears from a head injury. And he can't compose music anymore. And the heroine of the book becomes his muse. But I got the idea of that from Star Trek.
Oh.
Because I was sitting in the tire store having my snow tires swapped out for regular tires because I live in Idaho and you have to do that. And I'm waiting for my car to be done. And on the TV, there was an interview with William Shatner. And he was talking about how on the Star Trek set, they did this scene where there was this really loud explosion and it gave him tinnitus and how he almost committed suicide over it.
Yeah,
and
it's one of those things that terrifies me.
That's a book in the making. So how William Shatner's Star Trek episode, Tinnitus, ends up being a historical romance novel is this is how writers get our material. People say, where do you get your ideas? Well, this is where.
Yeah, total writer brain where anyone else saw that and didn't jump where you jumped, but it became a story for you.
They would just think, William Shatner, oh, that sucks, that happened to you. Me, I'm going, book idea.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating.
So you never know where those things are going to come from.
What does your writing process look like? Like, are you a plotter, a pantser? Do you have a particular approach to it?
I'm a complete pantser.
Okay.
Complete pantser. I never outline anything. And I write one draft.
Okay.
And people talk about, multiple drafts. I'm like, what? What's multiple? What are those? I start at the beginning, I end at the end, and that's it. And then I give it to my editor.
And does I was just it usually telling, come back with a lot of notes or is it pretty clean?
Usually no. In fact, I just went through for Eris Gone Wild. I had a huge rewrite and it was the first time I've ever really had a huge rewrite. And it was nerve-wracking to say the least because I'm not used to that. And I was like, whoa, now I understand what people say when they talk about revision because it never really happens to me because usually by the time I get to that point, my editor and I have discussed it. Okay. All along the way, and I'll be like, okay, I'm in the middle and I'm stuck and this is what's going on. And my editor will be like, no, I think you're fine. Keep going. Oh, okay. And then I'm reassured and I can keep going. So usually my process is very much like that. And it's on the fly. I make it up as I go. And I try to outline. I wish I could because to me it would be so much easier if I knew where I was going. But if every time I try it, what ends up happening is I feel like I'm wedded to it and then I can't, like it's set in stone and I can't change it and my mind gets fixed and then I can't veer off it.
Yeah.
So an outline for me becomes sort of imprisoning and it becomes it becomes boring because then if I know what's going to happen, it's not a surprise to me.
Yeah.
Because I kind of sort of discovered the journey of the people organically.
Yeah.
And so if I knew everything that was going to happen, if I had it all in little index cards and all plotted out ahead of time, I think I'd be bored.
That excitement of like the discovery isn't there.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah, completely. Because Dorinda Jones is like the biggest outliner that I can think of that I've talked to. And she writes these like insanely detailed outlines. Like, I don't remember how many thousand words they are, but they're a lot. And then she cranks the book out.
Can I just say that seems like Dante's seventh level of hell?
Yeah, exactly. But she then writes the book in like 5 days.
Yeah.
Like locks herself in a room and right. like the whole book is there. She just has to like fill it in.
Right.
And I was like, that sounds kind of nice. Like you just, it's all there and you just,
but I think it'd be very comforting.
The second you change something, you're like,
my question for her as an interviewer
outline?
Would be, what do you do if you get in the middle and realize this isn't going to work? What do you do?
It sounds like she starts to kind of wing it. Like she just leaves the outline alone and keeps going and like finds her way back to the outline. Or I don't know. I guess maybe she doesn't end up with huge changes because by the time she gets to the end of the outline,
maybe she's
spent so much time thinking about it.
She's anticipated all those things by then. I don't know.
She's sort of seen the story play out and it doesn't change by the time she starts writing. But yeah, I was like, oh.
I envy that process. I wish I could be more like that because there's nothing more agonizing for a pantser. And some people will, like Jennifer Ryan, who's sitting over here looking at us, who is also a pantser, will probably back me up on this, but there's nothing more agonizing than getting in the middle of the story and going, I have no idea where I'm going, and you're blank and you're stuck.
What do you do?
Usually for me, having been at it long enough and know my process well enough, I know now that if I'm stuck in the middle, it's usually because I've done something wrong.
Interesting.
Earlier.
Yeah.
And it's usually way more recent than I might think. So if I'm in the middle, let's say I'm in chapter 10, I don't necessarily need to go back to chapter 2. The problem's probably in chapter 9.
Oh, interesting.
And so that's the first place I now know to go look is just the previous scene or the previous chapter. Did I go off kilter here somewhere? And sometimes it's hard to know.
Yeah.
Because you read it and you think, well, this seems fine. In fact, I remember going through... I started a book for Avon. It's the only book I've ever had to dump, but I was 120 pages into it and it wasn't working. It just wasn't going to work. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. And experience told me there's a problem here. I have to fix it. And then I can go on because I've always fixed it before. And I gave it to my writer friends. I had my editor. I talked to my editor. It's like, we couldn't figure out what was wrong. I said, there's something wrong because I would be able to move forward. Something really is fundamentally flawed here. And I went on vacation for a week because I just couldn't look at it anymore. And I came back. And the minute I sat down, I looked at my storyboard and I went, I know what the problem is and it's not fixable.
Oh, wow.
There's no fixing it. And what I had done was I had set up, because in romance, and any romance author will tell you this, the two people have to be equals or there's no point to the story. In whatever way you set things up, they have to have equal power. They may not know it. They may feel like the other person has all the power and they don't have any. Usually the heroine's in that situation, but the hero can be in that situation too. But they have to be equals in strength and determination, and because no one wants to read about people who are weak, really. I mean, that's just not interesting. And so when you put these people in conflict, they both have to be equally strong or the book doesn't work. Well, the problem with this book wasn't that they weren't both equally strong. They were, but he had all the power. And by power, I mean he had power over her situation that he wasn't even aware of. But she knew it. And it made her have to watch everything she said and everything she did because the minute he found out who and what she really was, she'd have been out the door and that was not going to be acceptable for reasons that were in the plot, inherent to the story. That wasn't going to work. And so the story didn't work. And there was no way to give her more power, given the way the plot had been set up.
Because that would be the obvious, yeah.
Because I was like, okay, well, maybe I can give her more power, but there was no way to do it. The plot just didn't work. That's the only time in 30 years of doing this job that I've ever had that happen. And I had to jettison the whole book and start all over. And that was agony. That's
how long did it take you to accept that and like toss it?
Well, this 120 pages took me 4 or 5 months. So it was a 4 or 5 month of
But you got
agony,
back from vacation,
and then, right,
sat at the desk, realized
the
it, and
I
immediately
sat back
tossed
down
it.
After having been away from it for a week, I came back And the minute I sat down, I knew this isn't going to work, and I know why. And the minute I told my editor, she was like, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. There's no way to fix that. So even my editor, who has huge experience looking at it from a much more objective standpoint, even my editor didn't see it. Mm. So sometimes the process of being a pantser can be really agonizing.
Yeah.
But I couldn't imagine writing the whole thing ahead in an outline form. I couldn't imagine doing that either.
Yeah, I think
I've learned to hybrid sort of a little bit. I've learned to storyboard, which is a very useful tool for me. I'm very low tech about it. I mean, I know some people have Scrivener and they have, mm-hmm. you know, and I am very low tech. I have a cork board and index cards and little push pins. And then the push pins are colored for different things. So like a love scene is a red push pin and a kiss is a pink push pin and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's very low tech, but it's very useful because, which I don't think a computer program has the same value, because a physical board that you can look at on the wall, there's just something about, okay, my whole novel is right here in 36 or 42 index cards. It's all right here. There may be additional little things. So as I go now, I've learned to plot in the sense that I'll think, oh, you know what? This book is going to need that. And I'll stick an index card up somewhere in the middle.
Mm.
That's my idea of plotting. That's as plotting
it's
as
something.
I get.
Yeah.
But it's really useful to have that all in a visual. There's something really powerful, something empowering about seeing something in visual form.
Yeah.
A novel is a huge undertaking. Like you start out and you're so intimidated because you're on page one and there's at least 300 and some pages to go. You're thinking, oh my gosh, this is like climbing a mountain. Where do I start? Well, one step at a time, okay, but I need some direction, right? So it's very intimidating. So the more you can put in a visual form that you can just glance at, it's very, very powerful. So I've learned to really love and embrace my storyboard. But I could never be more complicated about it with a computer program or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's just too much bother. For me.
Yeah.
But I'm not very high tech.
I think a lot of newer authors get caught up in that. Like they don't trust that they're going to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And that's where the desire to do more heavy outlining. I think some people's brains just work that way, but I think sometimes people try to force themselves to outline even when their brain doesn't work that way, because then they'll feel like they can trust the work that they're putting in.
Well, they're not,
that's very true. End up the way it did for you.
They're not trusting their own process because they don't know their process yet.
Right.
They haven't written enough books. Nothing will teach you more about writing than writing a book. I mean, writing a book, there's no how-to manual that could ever substitute for starting a book and finishing it.
Yeah.
That is the best learning tool there is. And I think that authors who are new rely more on the outline because they don't trust themselves enough, which is understandable because they don't know.
Right.
But I also think too that authors are required, especially when they're new, they're required to do some kind of an outline or synopsis for publication purposes.
That's a good
point.
So they
can
too.
Sell.
Yeah.
So you do have to do some outlining, and I forced myself to do it. My editor now has worked with me long enough. She knows me well enough that, you know, when I tell her, do I have to do a synopsis for this? She says, why? You never follow it anyway.
So, who is your editor?
Erica Sang. Okay. And we've worked together for 18 years. So she knows pretty well what my process is now. She's very familiar with it for good or bad. But I think when you're new, it's useful to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
And then later you can abandon or keep which portions of outlining work for you and which don't.
But you don't know that until you try it.
But you don't know until you try different things. And it's also hard too to trust your process because, you know, everybody's always telling you, which is why I will never write a how-to book about writing, because everybody tells you, well, this is the way it should be done. When the truth is there is no right way to write. And anyone who tells you there is, pitch their writing book out the window because, you know, everyone says, well, write that rough draft. You have to write the draft. Well, I've never written a rough draft in my life. And I've written however many, 30 books. I'm like Dean Koontz. I start on page one, I write the whole thing, and then I stop. And that's my draft. I write one and only one draft. Well, that works for me. It wouldn't work for a lot of other authors.
Right.
But you don't know that until you... until you go through it, what works best.
Yeah.
So it's trial and error.
Like so everything. Would that be your biggest advice for so many of our listeners are also writers and aspiring authors. And like, is that your advice for them is just like, you got to sit down and do it to figure out what works?
Yes. My advice for, if any author asked me, what's your best advice? My advice is plant your butt in the chair and write the dang book.
Yeah.
Write the book. Don't straighten your notes out. Don't go clean the toilet. Don't, you know, oh, I need more research. At some point, you have to sit down and actually write the thing. And it's hard, right? See, people have this misconception about writing that it's some kind of magical thing. Like, oh, you're going to sit down and it's just going to flow out of you. And any real writer will tell you that is not how it works. Yeah. It's a lot of hard work and it's a lot of frustration and it's a lot more stressful and much harder than someone looking at it from the outside might think. And I knew some, when I worked in LA, I knew some actors in Hollywood and they weren't any name that anyone would recognize, but I was surprised to hear them talk about acting because there's nothing more tedious than film work because you have to do the same scene over and over and over and recite the same darn lines, take 27, say the same thing. And writing is a little bit like that because sometimes you have to go over something, you have to go over a paragraph or a page or a chapter or a scene over and over again going, okay, what next? Where? Why isn't this working? Where did I go wrong? What can I do better? Why doesn't this, you know, and it could be one sentence, it could be a whole scene. It's there's so many points at which you can make a mistake. And so you're constantly going back through it. So it's the tediousness of the effort and you have to power through that.
Yeah.
And it's so tempting to bail.
Yeah.
So plant your butt in the chair and write the darn thing. And most of the time when you doubt yourself, self-doubt is normal. It doesn't feel normal, but it is. And every author has it. And any author that tells you they don't is lying. That's my opinion.
So you still do like that.
Oh,
you
always, still get every step
into
and
the book.
And I think that if you didn't, it would make you less of a writer.
Yeah.
The more, you know, to some extent, there's a reason why tortured artists are tortured because they're so conscious of their work. And, you know, authors are no different that to some extent, this self-doubt is a part of being good at what you do. If you're not doubting, then you're complacent. And then maybe you're not as good as you could be.
Yeah. Yeah. The people who charge ahead and think like, this is the greatest thing ever. Like it probably isn't. And you're just not even listening
to
those instincts.
Sometimes that can work. I mean, see, and that's what's so hard is there's no rule. There's no like predicting it. Sometimes you sit down and write and you just fire it off and it is good.
Hmm.
And other times you sit down and fire it off and it's horrible. And other times you sit down and agonize and pick at everything and it's great. And other times you agonize and pick over it and it's crap.
Yeah.
So there's no way to know other than to just keep going and try again.
And I guess find people you trust who can look at it for you when
and
you can't see it anymore.
That's very important. I think one thing that if I was also going to offer advice to beginners, I would say there's a tendency to want, you've found kindred spirits, right? Other people who think like you and who want to write books and who love books and love words. And there's a tendency to want to share everything. And the fact of the matter is that you will make some great friendships in this job, but there will also be people who will use you and will try to steal from you or destroy you. And you have to hold some things a little close to the vest until trust is established. Because the people that you do find who are writing friends who you can trust are golden. Finding them is a process like everything else, where you have to be careful. It's like dating. It's like any other serious relationship of your life. It's like getting a job or anything else. You have to be a little bit, hold it a little bit close to the vest until you know you can trust people.
Yeah.
But yes, once you find writer friends that you can bounce ideas around with, it's magic. It's great.
Well, I'm like disappointed that I'm going to have to stop here, but we've just barely scratched the surface with you, but I hope you'll maybe consider coming back another time. And I think I'm going to be swinging through Idaho sometime next year. So.
Hey, if you're a skier or you like to camp or fish or hike, we have great hiking.
Camping
awesome.
And hiking, I'll give you. I tore my ACL skiing and I'm done with it.
Oh,
the recovery was a nightmare. So
yeah,
no skiing.
That would suck. But it's a great place. It's a beautiful place to visit.
Yeah.
Come see us.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thanks for having me.